Shit! Hey, how did my giving you great news spin out of control for me?
Well, the universe hates me, Skippy. Maybe hanging around me is giving you some bad karma. Anyway, how about you tell the science team and the crew your good news? We need to get the crew started on training to use the new system to fly the ship. I assume you have bodaciously amazing PowerPoint slides for training materials. Oh, crap, I forgot all about that. I will have to create a training manual and revise the control displays in the bridge and CIC and program simulations. What a huge pain in the ass!
How long will that take? I asked anxiously, knowing our hotshot pilots would be bugging me about training 2 seconds after they heard the news.
Huh? Oh, I just did that. A full training regimen is available now.
You see what you did there, right? Creating a training program in a nanosecond is why we expect you to do the
impossible. It was 0.7 nanoseconds, smartass.
God damn it! I just did it again! Joe, the next time I boast about my incredible awesomeness, please remind me how much that gets me into trouble.
Sure thing, Skippy. I bit my lip because I knew there was no way that arrogant little shithead could resist bragging about himself.
Again, thank you, from the bottom of my heart. That goes for all of us unworthy monkeys. We truly appreciate it.
Ha! As if! You are not capable of understanding my
Crap! I just did it again!
Yeah, well, until you can purge that energy virus from the ship, us monkeys being able to fly it by ourselves is just a theory.
Good point.
I shouldn't have mentioned it yet, but I figured you are drifting in space with nothing else to do, so I was making conversation.
Skippy, you are right that I have absolutely nothing to do but wait until the dropship power cells are cold and dead.
Wait! Before you start singing show tunes at me, I'm going to read about what the hell kind of trouble Perkins has gotten into this time.
Good idea, Joe. I took a few liberties with filling in the details. The report I downloaded was kind of skimpy.
She's really in trouble?
Well, she was. Now the entire population of Paradise is facing extinction.
Oh, crap.
Hey, now that my suit is working again, can I pull up the report in my suit visor?
Done.
Text appeared in my helmet visor. I could control how fast it scrolled by eye clicks. It looked like a long report, but I had nothing else to do.
Thanks. I'll start reading.
Chapter 3 Emily Perkins raced through the dense forest as if she were being chased by a bear, running flat out. The Ruhar combat skin suit she wore enhanced her speed and included sensors and stabilizers to compensate for her slow human reaction time, but the blinking yellow dots in the synthetic view projected onto the inside of her helmet visor showed the enemy was getting closer with every second. Every time she stumbled on the uneven ground, every time she had to leap over a fallen log, every time she ducked to clear a low-hanging tree branch, she lost ground to her pursuers. Time. They needed time.
Jarrett, cover fire,
Perkins ordered, hating the words as she spoke, but they had no choice. Jesse Coulter and Dave Chaika were already dead. She had seen them fall to enemy fire, and their icons now blinked red as their suits' reported life functions had ceased. It was a disaster. A total disaster. She was about to lose her entire team in the space of a few minutes. The enemy was too fast, too skilled, and humans had too little time with their advanced Ruhar combat gear. They never had a chance. Coulter and Chaika had remained behind to set up an ambush, so Perkins, Jarrett, and their alien liaison Nert might get away, but their sacrifice had been for nothing. Even firing from a well-chosen defilade position, behind the crest of a rise in the ground and between fallen logs that gave good cover, the two human soldiers accounted for only 4 enemy dead before they had both been killed by guided rockets that shredded their bodies despite the tough but flexible skin suits.
On it, Shauna replied and dropped to the ground instantly, rolling over to rest behind a tree. Her ragged breathing made her head bob around so much inside the helmet that she could not eye-click to engage the targeting system, so she relied on the scope of her rifle. 7 yellow dots were advancing in good order, 2 on the left, 2 on the right, and 3 in the center. The enemy moved fast, so fast over broken ground. Their tactics were excellent, leapfrogging from cover to cover, with one group laying down suppressing fire while the other two groups raced ahead. Since Jesse and Dave had shot 4 of the enemy, they had grown wary of the sting even lowly humans could inflict, so they had taken to using cover wherever they could find it.
She looked away from the rifle's targeting scope to see the terrain around her, verifying the info from the synthetic view projected onto the inside of her helmet's visor. A little voice in her head reminded her that those 7 yellow dots were a guess, a composite image based on data collected by her suit's passive sensors. The sensors had a wide variety of data to work with. As the enemy moved, they created vibrations in the air that were picked up as faint sounds, although the enemy's own suits sent out dampener waves that partly canceled out their own vibrations and could also project false vibrations at a distance of up to a quarter kilometer. By moving at high speed through the air, the enemy left ionized trails through the air, but these too could be false sensor data because ion trails could be masked or faked. Heat from the overworked bodies and the powered suits was a good source of passive location data. Except in combat mode, their mech suits could temporarily store heat in a sink so the suit surface matched the surrounding temperature. Often, the best source of data were brief bursts of laser light as the enemy's suits kept up a line-of-sight data link between them, but her own suit could only detect backscatter of those laser pulses, and the enemy suits constantly projected false pulses to confuse her sensors. Like her own Ruhar skin suit, the enemy's armor had a limited stealth and chameleon capability, so she could not even trust her own eyes. The enemy could be approximately where the visor indicated, or those could be false images based on outdated or faked data. Stilling her breathing, she successfully eye-clicked after 2 missed attempts and adjusted to sniper mode. The yellow dots changed to yellow circles to show the true, probable location of the enemy, and Shauna cursed to herself. Those rings displaying the circular error of probability were big, too big to be useful to her for targeting. Worse, 3 of the circles were a pale, blinking yellow, showing the sensors did not trust the data on those 3 enemy soldiers. And there weren't only 7 circles. Off to the right were 2 fuzzy pink circles, the visor's way of telling her there might be 9 of the enemy facing her. She told herself there could be as few as 5 actual people out there chasing her, but 5-to-1 odds were nearly as bad as 9-to-1. "Damn it!" Shauna screamed in her head, but no sound came from her mouth. The shout would pinpoint her position to the enemy as surely as if she had turned off her stealthware and stood up in full view. "Think, Shauna, think. I need to find..." One of the yellow circles became a bright yellow dot with a blinking green arrow pointing to it, which Shauna knew meant her suit had picked up a transient, a short spike of data. Probably a sound, such as someone stepping on a dry twig in the forest. The enemy would know their mistake and move to throw off her targeting, so she reacted without hesitation, gently depressing her rifle's trigger button. Invisible bolts of maser energy lanced out, stitching a line across trees and undergrowth, and she heard a panicked scream. Shauna did not wait to verify she had hit the target. She rolled to her right into a shallow depression and wiggled backwards, then got on hands and knees when she could, crawling quickly and keeping low. Although the maser energy was invisible to the naked eyes of her and the enemy, all their suits could see the maser bolts clearly, and her position had been pinpointed exactly. The tree she had used for cover was being sliced apart by maser beams, chunks blowing off the trunk as the water within the wood boiled and exploded from the microwave energy. She was pelted by flying splinters of charred wood, but none of the deadly beams hit her. Now the targeting data was resolving as the enemy rushed her position, 3 circles becoming dots as her suit became supremely confident of the enemy's location. "Shit!" she cursed inwardly. Another yellow dot wasn't moving, representing the soldier she had shot, but the formerly pink circles to her right were now yellow dots racing past her. The enemy was engaging with only 3 soldiers, while the others continued to pursue Perkins and Nert. Damn it. She had no chance to do anything about the soldiers that already outflanked her.
"Colonel Perkins, at least 4 have gotten past me and are moving in your direction."
The only reply was a click, as Perkins could not risk giving away her own position by transmitting more than nanosecond burst.
"Okay, what to do next?"
Shauna could run. The direction would not matter, as she couldn't hope to escape. To qualify for infantry duty with the U.S. Army, she had trained to the point where every muscle in her body screamed at her, to the point where soft tissue injuries risked ruining her dreams. A partially torn rotator cuff, a sprained ACL, sharp heel pain from plantar fasciitis, she had not let any of that delay her training, not let mere pain stop her from proving she was physically capable of keeping up with male soldiers. Now, With the incredible technology of the Ruhar combat skin suit, she could run, jump, lift just like any man. In some ways, her better fine motor control allowed her to handle a rifle better than a human man. That is why she had been designated the team's sniper. Sniper. That's what she needed to do. The three yellow dots in front of her had stopped moving and were now slowly becoming circles as her suit lost confidence in their exact location. She knew the enemy was similarly unsure of her position, perhaps more unsure as she had stopped moving before they did, and she had not been racing through the forest making noise. Slowly, she rose up onto her elbows and eye-clicked to dim the synthetic view, zooming in her sight on the real world, relying on old-fashioned photons reflecting off objects into her eyes. Nothing. She used the dimmed synthetic view to guide her eyes, but there wasn't anything useful to see out there. Trees, bushes, undergrowth, vines hanging down. The area was near a river, and the ground was spongy and swampy in spots, with plants like dark-colored ferns growing densely in clumps. The vines were a hazard. They were not poisonous, and most did not have thorns, but they hung down, and a running person could get tripped or tangled easily. She saw vines swaying where the enemy must have passed by, for there was little wind that day to stir the air. Swaying vines only told her where the enemy had been, not where they were, and the circles in her visor slowly grew larger as her suit lost track of the enemy.
There!
A clump of ferns moved in a sudden jerk, and Shauna's pinky finger selected her rifle's railgun mode. Mazers were no good for shooting through underbrush. She needed the explosive-tipped flechettes of the railgun. Ruhar rifles were almost silent, as the mazers made no sound at all until they hit something. In conditions of rain or high humidity, the air could sizzle quietly as the beam passed through. But that was minor, compared to the explosive crack of Krestang projectile weapons. Even the flechettes were quiet, because the electromagnetic rails accelerated the flechettes to just below the local speed of sound, avoiding a supersonic boom. The flechettes had a limited ability to guide themselves to a target, and they had tiny rocket motors to extend their range and kinetic impact so the explosive-tipped flechettes hit with nearly the same velocity they left the rifle barrel. Shauna had at first been skeptical of a rifle with such low muzzle velocity until she gained experience firing the weapon, and now she loved it. Even the nearly silent railgun could be detected by enemy sensors, but the emitted sound was rarely loud enough to pinpoint the shooter's location. Against Krestang, she could select the double-tap mode, a mazer bolt followed by a flechette round. The mazer beam hit the rigid armor of a Krestang suit, burning off and weakening the outer layer and providing a hot spot for the flechette to guide itself into. When the flechette hit the weakened area of the armor, it would punch through and launch its binary explosive inside to churn a Krestang body into jelly. Another press of her pinky kicked the selector up into three-round burst mode, and she gently pressed the trigger button. The rifle had an internal weight that launched forward as the electromagnetic rails accelerated each flechette, so she felt almost no kick against her shoulder, and the rifle's muzzle barely moved between rounds. Three flechettes reached out, and she saw an arm flung up above the ferns as an enemy was struck. She ducked down and hugged the ground as returning fire scorched the tree branches above her. One down, two to go. But she could not move from her position. One of the enemy was firing to keep her pinned down, as the other no doubt tried to circle around and outflank her. The nearly continuous enemy fire scorched the air, confusing her suit's sensors. Confused her passive sensors. But she had other options. She rolled over onto her back and fired her rifle's mazer in a long burst to make the enemy take cover. Then she reached onto her belt and tossed upward a hummingbird-sized sensor drone. The tiny device soared 20 feet over her head and zipped away, unable to climb higher, or its sensors would be blocked by the tree canopy. The mini-drone survived for 5 seconds, its active sensor pulses attracting attention and ensuring its quick death. 5 seconds was long enough, more than Shauna had hoped. Having received data from the powerful sensor pulses of the drone, Shauna's suit had mapped out a momentarily clear picture of the surrounding forest, and she took in the info in a flash. One enemy was lying prone 100 meters away toward the river, while the other soldier was racing on her right, nearly even with her. Shauna exploded up onto her knees, sent a barrage of maser pulses at the running soldier, and dropped back to the ground in less than 2 seconds, holding her breath as the branches above her were sliced by return fire. Another one down, her suit clearly indicated she had killed or disabled the running soldier. She was now facing only one enemy, and hope surged within her, hope that was unexpected and unwanted, as thinking about the possibility of survival was a distraction she could not afford. She needed to... Her visor blanked out, going clear, as the suit's sensors temporarily were knocked offline. EMP, she realized in a panic. The lone remaining enemy soldier must have fired a rocket toward her, a rocket that did not explode, but instead generated a powerful electromagnetic pulse that partially disrupted the mechanisms of her skin suit. She was temporarily blind, other than what her eyes could see and what her ears could hear. With a thumb, she broke the seal on her helmet faceplate and swung it upward, holding her breath to listen with desperation. While her suit's sensors were blind, the enemy would have been unaffected by the EMP, as the energy weapon would have been tuned not to emit frequencies used by the enemy mech suit. What to do? She couldn't stay where she was, and her suit's power assist motors were fully active, though her own muscles had to provide all the guidance without suit sensors scanning the ground ahead to prevent her from stumbling. She turned to look behind her, where the underbrush thinned out, the ground there being saturated with water in a marsh. The ground where she had taken cover was spongy, and as she moved, the water broke away in a sucking sound that made her cringe, for the sound surely gave away her exact location. Holding still, she listened, and heard a crashing sound to her left. Having little choice as her sensors were still only 70% reset, she smoothly rolled up to one knee and scanned the forest to the left, seeing only ferns and low-hanging tree branches swaying. She squeezed off a 3-round railgun burst, feeling the stock buzzing lightly against her shoulder. Switching back to the maser beam, she was knocked to the ground as a maser burned into her right shoulder from behind. The sound she heard must have been a decoy, the enemy tossing a stick or something to her right. She had been a fool, and now she paid the price. The skin suit had absorbed part of the maser energy, partly by the suit dropping stealth and going silver to reflect the high-energy photons, and partly by the outer layer flaking away to expel the heat. It was not enough, not to compensate for a close-range direct hit. Her right side was immobile, the helmet now totally offline. Painfully, with the suit's motors almost fighting against her, she held the rifle with her left hand and fell back against a tree to face right, looking for the enemy. And seeing nothing. The enemy's stealthware and chameleon capability was fully active. Without synthetic vision, she had to hope she could detect movement out of her peripheral vision as her Ruhar trainers had taught her. What the hell? The enemy was probably staring right at her, gloating as she slumped against the tree, nearly helpless. With nothing else to do, she screamed defiance and cut loose with the maser on semi-auto mode, sweeping the forest in front of her. Her rash action was rewarded by a glimpse of an enemy silhouette lit up by maser bolts, just as a railgun dart slammed into her chest. Emily Perkins's heart skipped a beat as she saw the icon representing Sergeant Shauna Jarrett go red, to reflect yet another human was dead on the battlefield. Perkins was now the only human survivor of her team, with her Ruhar liaison Nert Derndorf the only living being on her side in the battle.
Nert, go ahead.
No, Colonel Perkins, I will not leave you. We are almost there.
Perkins did not waste time or energy arguing with the teenage alien.
To the right, along this stream.
She turned, her skin suit stabilizing her clumsy motions to prevent her from falling in the high-speed maneuver. With the power assist of her suit motors, she was running at the speed of an all-out sprint, a speed that by herself she could only keep up for 50 meters or less, but she had been running at that pace for a full 2 kilometers away from the river. It was blindingly, astonishingly fast, and it was not enough. 4 icons representing the enemy were gaining on them, gaining rapidly, with 2 veering left and 2 right. The enemy was trying to encircle the 2 survivors, and there was little Perkins could do. Splashing along the streambed, she and Nert were momentarily away from the enemy's line of sight as she could see her goal. A defensible position. When she began running up and away from the stream to a low ridge, She urged Nert onward, knowing the young alien was holding back his own pace to cover her. As Nert ran, he was firing his rifle's maser backwards blindly. She didn't bother to stop him, for just then she reached the top of the ridge and folded her legs to crash down into a shallow swale, rolling over onto her belly and bringing her rifle up to sight over the ridgeline. The position was not as defensible as it had looked when she scouted the area that morning. The terrain was terribly exposed behind her, and the ridge was no more than 3 feet tall, barely enough for her to take cover behind. Nert ran toward her, and she raised her left hand, waving to him. The alien cadet charged up the slope in two long strides, ducking under a vine and bounding high over the ridge top, whooping triumphantly, until his body jerked as he was hit by a maser beam and a railgun dart at the same time. He fell forward to hit the ground hard with a thud Perkins felt through her suit.
"Nert! Nert!"
Perkins screamed frantically, dropping her rifle and crawling to the cadet. But he was already gone.
"Son of a—"
Perkins bit her lip inside the helmet. As the only survivor, success of the mission was solely her responsibility now. Shoving her emotions down inside herself, she reached for her rifle and yanked a spare power cell off Nert's waist belt. The counter on top of her rifle indicated she had only 6 flechette rounds and 18% energy charge remaining. The maser exciter would eventually burn out, but that took thousands of shots, nothing she needed to worry about right then. Keeping low, she crawled to her left, cringing as she bumped into Nert's limp form, moving on knees and elbows toward a fallen tree where she could hide behind the upturned roots that would give her good cover for—
Ow!
Something slammed into her butt cheeks from the left, knocking her to the ground hard. Apparently crawling on her knees lifted her too high off the ground, and she had paid for her mistake, a lesson she should have remembered from crawling under low-hanging wire all the way back in basic training.
Stupid, stupid!
Her visor showed the skin suit had properly gone rigid when its proximity sensor field detected the incoming railgun round, and at the extreme angle, the round had failed to penetrate. The damage was done anyway, as she could not move her legs. Something vital in the skin suit's motor mechanism must have been knocked offline. Laboriously, she crawled forward on her belly, using only her hands, sliding the rifle ahead of her and dragging herself to it. Only 3 more meters and she could turn over, her back to the protection of the tree roots and a partially obstructed view in the direction of the river. Her visor was showing only large, fuzzy yellow circles as the suit had lost track of the enemy. No matter. They had to come from only 2 directions, and she could cover both. Sliding the rifle forward again, she eye-clicked to open a menu option and selected it. With one last effort, she heaved herself to the down tree, pulling herself onto her backside with difficulty since her legs had become useless. Sighting along her rifle, she scanned the ground in front of her, seeing nothing. Turning to the right, she had the briefest glance of an enemy helmet and rifle popping up over a bush. Then a burst of darts hit her. Chapter 4
"Ceasefire! Ceasefire!"
the leader ordered.
"She's dead! Stop shooting, you idiot!"
He was angry because the soldier who had killed the alien stupidly stood up and fired his maser at the prone target, exposing himself to potential enemy snipers and giving away the position of the entire team.
"I got her!"
the soldier exulted, pointing his rifle at the dead human.
"She's the last one. They're all dead.
7 of them. 6 humans. Against 16 of us. And only the 4 of us survived. That is no victory to celebrate. We should have killed them all in the first 5 minutes. Humans are slow and weak, and they barely have the brain power of a slug. But they killed 10 of us. The commander is not going to be pleased."
The leader opened his helmet faceplate and spat in disgust.
"They had the advantage," the soldier protested meekly. "They were in a defensive posture, and they knew the terrain. They only arrived here this morning with no time to prepare a fixed defense."
The leader waved a hand to dismiss the soldier.
"This team's performance was shameful. I am ashamed to lead you. You clumsy fools."
He clearly was taking none of the responsibility on his own shoulders.
"Almost lost."
Perkins laughed softly as her faceplate swung open, coming down off of the adrenaline high of the war game exercise.
You did almost lose, she pointed out to the leader of the Ruhar cadet team. She knew they were cadets by the academy logos on the arms of their skin suits. With her face played open, the visor was no longer feeding her a false image of stealth wear masking the training suits, because those units had no stealth or chameleon capabilities. The war game had been impressively realistic. She could feel the realism. Her hips hurt, because when a non-existent railgun dart had hit her in the backside, the war game controller had slammed her suit into the ground and deactivated the skin suit's leg motors. Trees, which moments before had appeared shot up by maser beams, were now intact, because there had been no actual masers, nor flechettes, nor rockets. None of her team were dead or injured. The war game controller AI would not allow a participant to harm anyone, or allow a participant to hurt themselves by clumsiness or stupidity. In that way, the war game was unrealistic, but Perkins could see the wisdom of preventing trainees from silly accidents that would delay their training.
Ah! The leader spun toward her angrily. Silence, human! You did lose!
We lost this skirmish. We haven't lost the battle, Perkins said quietly.
What?
The lead cadet asked, tapping the side of his helmet and shaking his head.
I couldn't hear you. What did you say?
He stepped forward, leaning down and menacing the prone human with his inert rifle.
You should not.
His left foot stepped on a twig which snapped with an odd clicking sound. Then he and his team of three joined the dead. Their skin suits went rigid. Lights pulsed inside their visors and alarms blared in their ears. Unable to control his suit, the cadet wobbled and slowly fell over to thump to the forest floor a few yards from Perkins. She heard a string of curse words her helmet did not bother to translate. The mines her team planted that morning had become active when she activated them with an eye click, moments before the game controller declared her dead.
Human, you tricked us!
Perkins shifted in her immobile suit to get more comfortable. She was going to be lying there a while now that the game had declared her dead.
Yeah, looks like it, huh?
You have no honor!
The cadet leader twisted his neck toward her so he could speak, as his ability to transmit through the communications network had cut off when he died.
I will file a formal protest. Your tactics are not realistic. In a real battle, that explosion would have killed your team also.
Yes, it probably would have, Perkins agreed.
You booby-trapped your own position? The cadet asked incredulously.
We assumed we would be overrun, she admitted. You Ruhar have advantages of size, speed, skill, and familiarity with skin suits. It seemed unlikely we could escape from your team, even though you are cadet trainees.
You planned for your own deaths?
The cadet was astonished, as if such an idea was outside his imagination. We planned to achieve our objective. The cadet snorted in what Perkins thought was a very human gesture.
You have achieved nothing.
Oh, really? Perkins turned her head and raised an eyebrow, a gesture she knew the Ruhar understood. While you were chasing us, your team left your assigned patrol area along the river, didn't you? She almost added asshole, but kept that remark to herself. The Ruhar sucked in a shocked breath.
You tricked me!
He then spoke words that Perkins's helmet did not translate, and his suit relaxed, then restored itself to function. Perkins spoke Ruhar reasonably well, but she wasn't able to understand most of what the cadet said, so rapid-fire was his speech. The cadet barked orders to the three members of his team, whose suits also reactivated. The four stood up and engaged in an animated argument, hands gesturing emphatically. The cadet leader jabbed a finger toward Perkins, shouting and stamping a foot while he argued. Though the Ruhar had somehow deauthorized her helmet translator, Perkins was able to follow most of the argument among the four. She had even learned new Ruhar curse words that she needed to research the meaning of later.
You're not supposed to be moving,
Perkins spoke loud and slowly in Ruhar to assure the message was understood by the cadets. According to the rules, the four of you are dead. That message was received by the four Ruhar and sparked another round of argument, until the lead cadet made a slashing motion. Perkins's imperfect skills at understanding the common Ruhar language made his words sound stilted, but the meaning was clear.
I will take responsibility. The decision is mine. We go now.
The cadet held the rifle over his head for emphasis, then turned to glare at Perkins and shifted his weight onto one leg. For a moment, she feared he would kick her with the assisted power of a skin suit, which could hurt her badly. They locked eyes, the cadet glaring hatred at her, before he turned and ran back to the river. His three teammates joined him, though initially running without enthusiasm. One of the Ruhar turned back to look toward Perkins, unsure of what to do, then followed the others with a sad, apologetic smile. "Nert," Perkins called out, unable to see behind herself as her own skin suit was still rigidly immobile. "You all right over there?"
"Yes, Colonel Perkins, I am fine. How are you? That was fun."
"I'd be better if that jackass hadn't broken the war game rules and run back to his patrol area. It's up to Strebich and Bonsu now."
"Miss Irene and Mr. Derek, I mean, Captains Strebich and Bonsu, are brave and smart," Nert said hopefully. "They will not fail."
Perkins relaxed in the suit. Trying to look around was only making her neck muscles sore. "They had better succeed, or the only result of our actions will be to demonstrate that humans have no place serving alongside Ruhar."
"This is crazy," Derek remarked. "Certifiably lunatic nuts."
"You know that, right?"
Irene grimaced and instinctively flinched when a large native fish bumped against the cockpit canopy of their Dobra fighter. The curious creature scraped its bony lips along the see-through material, the suction cups on the ends of its flippers leaving a trail of yellowish slime. Irene tapped on the inside of the canopy, startling the fish, which darted away. In the murky river water, she could see shapes moving in a school as fish circled the strange object that had dropped out of the sky into their private underwater world.
"This was your idea."
"No." Derek gave the pilot in front of him a disparaging look. "I mentioned it as one possible tactic, a far-fetched one. I didn't think this is what you would choose."
"Colonel Perkins approved it."
Irene toggled through the exterior passive sensors again, finding nothing within range.
"We're supposed to keep senior officers out of trouble," Derek reminded her.
"Yes, Captain Bonsu."
Irene waved him away, irritated. After saving 40,000 Ruhar lives by blowing up a tropical island, the entire team had received a temporary promotion of one grade. That was why Perkins was now a lieutenant colonel, while Shauna, Jesse, and Dave were now sergeants. The promotions were supposed to be made permanent soon at an official ceremony, but so far the team had been too busy in the field.
"This idea may be crazy, but it's the only plan either of us has thought of that could do something useful in this war game. If the hamsters had given us a real gunship other than this broken-down piece of crap, we could have joined the air battle."
"That hamster crew chief will blow a gasket when he sees fish guts in his precious turbines," Derek said with concern.
He had kept the turbines turning over at minimum power, a setting normally used only for inspections while the Dobra was on a ramp or in a hangar. With the turbines rotating, they created a pressure that prevented troublesome aquatic organisms from going up inside the delicate parts of the engines if any fish or snails or things Derek didn't want to think about got near the intakes. They were gently sucked in and hurried along past the slowly rotating turbine blades out the exhaust ports, which were fully open. Anyone on the surface of the river might notice a change in water flow, but the current was already disrupted by having a Ruhar fighter submerged on the stony bottom. Unless the observer was familiar with the usual pattern of water flow in that part of the river, nothing would look unusual.
"That wrench spinner gave you the idea," Irene snorted. "He didn't intend to."
"Ah, that's his problem. I know he is part of the reason we got assigned this hangar queen instead of a frontline warbird."
Irene was still angry about that. 3 days before the war game commenced, the two human pilots had been thrilled to learn they would participate as part of the Green Team air support. Then their hopes for getting into action were crushed when they saw the sad piece of crap Dobra they would be flying. That particular airframe had literally been sitting in the back corner of a hangar for months, being steadily stripped for parts to keep other birds in flyable condition. Even with a battle group now based at Paradise, supplies of some critical materials were in short supply.
Some genius at Ruhar Fleet Command had thought it important to get an impressively large number of ships and aircraft to Paradise as quickly as possible, probably hoping to dissuade the Kristang from any adventuresome thoughts of retaking the planet. While the amount of military gear arriving had indeed been impressive, the follow-through effort had been weak and poorly organized. Aircraft, dropships, and even a few smaller ships had been pulled offline within weeks due to lack of replacement for worn-out parts or consumable supplies. So when the local fleet commander announced plans for an extensive war game covering a quarter of the planet, the supply personnel had nearly panicked. A significant number of aircraft were not airworthy due to one fault or another, and some of the aircraft assigned to flying duty lacked their full complement of weapons or had glitchy sensors. Irene understood the supply problem. As a U.S. Army helicopter pilot, she had experienced frustrating issues with keeping her Blackhawk in flyable condition going back even before her service in Nigeria. If the Ruhar had shrugged and explained there were not enough aircraft available to waste on lowly humans, she would have been pissed, but she also would have accepted the rationale behind the decision. Rather than being honest and giving a good effort to find a flyable hull for Irene and Derek, the maintenance people at the airbase had done the absolute minimum they could to comply with high-level orders to assure the primitive humans were able to participate in the war game. That is why the two human pilots had been assigned to a fighter hurriedly cobbled together from whatever used parts were available. The missile bay was empty, not because the exercise was only a war game. They were empty because the rotating magazine in the missile bay was missing entirely. Only a couple sad and lonely brackets occupied that space. The Dobra was not capable of carrying missiles, and only one of its maser turrets contained an actual maser cannon, although the crew chief had insisted strongly that no one attempt to fire the cannon, and the power leads were disconnected. The crew chief had also warned the pair of humans not to run up the turbines past 36% of max power, to the point where Irene and Derek had to sign a formal acknowledgement of that warning to earn the dubious privilege of taking the piece of crap into the air. Derek had been pissed to the point of suggesting they run up a turbine until it burned out on the ramp, forcing the Ruhar to admit they had provided a substandard aircraft to their pet humans. "Derek, chill," Irene had chided her fellow pilot. "We fly this piece of crap or we don't fly at all. I want to fly." She tapped his chest with a fingernail. "Getting in the air is all this thing can do." Derek had kicked a landing gear strut in disgust. "No way can we keep formation with a combat air patrol." He knew the Green Team air commander for the war game would not have hampered her chance for success by including humans in her defensive air patrol anyway. The poor condition of their Dobra only provided a convenient excuse. "They'll assign us to fly recon, or as a decoy." "Probably. But we don't have to stick to whatever role they give us. We know what this bird can't do. Think, Derek. We need to think what we could do in this thing." Derek had thought, and Irene had thought, and they had discarded a dozen ideas before Derek made an offhand comment about how he had once watched a Dobra undergoing testing back when he was working as a sort of mascot at a Ruhar airbase, before Perkins and her team had blasted Kristang ships out of the sky with giant maser cannons nobody knew existed. Derek had intended the comment as a joke, but Irene thought of the possibilities, and after discussing the idea with Perkins, they got approval for their crazy stunt. This is why, 20 minutes into the war game, they had faked a turbine blade failure and been ordered to set their crippled bird down and wait until the war game was over. The air boss for the war game was happy to have the two pesky humans off his board, as that was one less thing for him to worry about. Instead of setting down as ordered, Irene and Derek had turned off their transponder and flown at treetop level or below, sometimes following roads or streams where gaps in the tree cover allowed their Dobra to almost hover with the wings retracted most of the way. They had flown a course along air corridors that Green Team Intel had indicated were gaps in Yellow Team sensor coverage, until they reached a stream and followed it down to where it met a river. At a bend in the river was a deep pool, overhung by large trees and with a stony bottom that was mostly clear of sticky silt. There they had hovered lower and lower until the Dobra touched the water and Derek had cut the power. The sophisticated Ruhar gunship fighter settled into the water, sinking to the bottom where it remained, its active sensors powered off, and with turbines turning very slowly. They had sunk the Dobra before dawn that day. Now it was early afternoon. Through a super-thin whip antenna sticking above the surface, they had been able to follow progress of the war game through the Green Team tactical data link and through the Dobra's computer, picking up Yellow Team signals and guessing what the other side was doing.
"Heads up," Derek whispered, interpreting Irene's train of thought. "Sensors are picking up multiple bogeys,"
he warned of unidentified contacts. Then the system gave him positive confirmation. The contacts fit the signatures of Yellow Team aircraft.
"We've got company."
He transferred the sensor data to Irene's console in the front part of the tandem cockpit.
"Three bandits, weeds at 042.
Derek used the term weeds to indicate the enemy aircraft were at such low altitude they would be scraping the treetops.
"I see them."
The Dobra's passive sensors showed her one troop transport aircraft escorted by two fighters. Using typical cover formation for a three-ship flight, the fighters were ahead and slightly above the transport. Irene's lips curled in a wolfish smile inside her helmet, and she pressed the button to flip her visor down, automatically putting her flight suit on internal power and life support. With the Yellow Team aircraft already passing overhead, those fighters would be badly out of position to defend the transport from an attack that came behind them.
"Button up. We are out of here."
"Buttoned up. Turbines ready," Derek reported. "Rocket assist online and at your command."
"Acknowledged," Irene said tersely, all business now that they were going into action.
Although the gunship's twin turbines were powerful, and their blades made of a super-tough composite, they could not apply enough power for takeoff while the engines were submerged. If they had to rely only on the turbines, their Dobra was going to remain at the bottom of the river. Fortunately, the Dobra was equipped with rocket thrusters. Those compact but powerful units could be used when the fighter climbed to an altitude where the air was too thin for the turbines to provide useful thrust, or for a quick burst of speed. But they mostly had another use. When a heavily loaded Dobra was taking off vertically, the rocket thrusters provided the extra energy to get the aircraft off the ground and up to speed where the wings provided lift. With the Dobra submerged in a river, Irene set the thrusters on low power for an easy, sustained burn, rather than the sudden kick in the pants they provided on full power.
3, 2, 1, go,
she announced in a calm voice, and the Dobra rocketed off the river bottom. Her view was instantly clouded as the thrusters stirred up sand and caused water under the ship to flash into steam. Anyone above the river could not fail to see an unusual disturbance under the river's normally placid surface, and that sight would soon give their location away to the Yellow Team aircraft. But Irene increased power to the thrusters, and the Dobra burst free of the water in seconds. She had a momentary view of a very terrified fish when the creature slid off the canopy and into open air above the river, and seeing the fish's wide-open mouth and bulging eyes almost made her laugh. Then Irene pulled her focus back to the task at hand.
"Nose is cold," Derek advised, reminding the pilot their active sensors were still powered down.
"Go active. Light him up," Irene authorized.
Derek turned a selector switch to bring the sensor pulse gear from standby to active, and pulses of energy radiated from the Dobra's forward sensor platform.
"Targets painted, targets acquired," he announced from the rear seat's weapons console.
He did not need to wait for Irene's acknowledgement or order, as they had agreed on tactics for various scenarios, and there wasn't time for back-and-forth chit-chat in modern air combat. The pilot was flying a dash profile straight at the enemy aircraft, pushing the turbines as hard as they could go. As the Dobra soared above the tree canopy that lined the river, the Yellow Team fighters began to brake in hard turns that rapidly bled off their airspeed. The transport went to full power, surging forward and upward, deploying countermeasures to supplement its stealth field. Derek was impressed by the opposing team's reaction time. They must have turned immediately after their sensors detected the Green Team Dobra coming out of nowhere. He imagined the Yellow Team pilots and the remote air boss had to be screaming the Ruhar equivalent of "Where the fuck did that Dobra come from?" But they weren't acting panicked. The hamster air crews were skilled, they were disciplined, and they were in command of awesomely capable aircraft. And they were doomed. While still underwater, Derek had selected targets and flight patterns for all of their missiles theoretically carried by the Dobra. The fact that their weapons bay was empty made no difference in the war game, for the computer system that ran the game and functioned as referee acted as if their fighter was fully equipped as it would be in real combat. Even before the Dobra climbed above the treetops, Derek had opened the weapons bay door, and the virtual rotary launcher spun rapidly, ripple-firing every virtual missile they carried, plus decoys and their own countermeasures.
"Winchester on birds,"
Derek announced, indicating their entire supply of theoretical missiles had been expended. The air around the fighter remained clear, except for river water explosively evaporating as the Dobra approached the speed of sound. Then there was a burst of vapor, as breaking the sound barrier compressed the air in a cone shape behind them. In reality, the air remained clear, but in the enhanced synthetic vision of their helmet visors, the air was filled with angry yellow flares of missile launches, then white contrails, twisting violently as their missiles and decoys jinked to avoid defensive maser fire from the targets. Without taking time to comment, Derek poured maser fire at the transport from his own powerful maser cannons. Though he knew the transport shields would deflect most of the maser bolts, the energy impacting the shields would create a plasma that would light up the target for his missiles while fuzzing the transport's point defense sensors. As he watched, the missiles he had fired lanced in toward their targets, several going off course as they were confused by enemy countermeasures or falling victim to defensive maser fire. The loss of a few missiles made no difference to the end result. Derek had launched so close to the enemy aircraft that they had only seconds to react, and it was not enough. First, the transport exploded as two missiles scored direct hits almost at the same time as another missile ripped into one of the fighters. The second fighter survived long enough for Derek to switch his maser cannons onto it and send one pulse of maser energy toward it. Then the wargame computer determined the second fighter was also disabled and falling, breaking apart in midair. Derek did not pump a fist to celebrate. He did not exult at their victory. He focused on staying alive. Before they died, those two fighters had each launched two missiles, which were now racing toward the Dobra that did not have any protection from an effective stealth field. While the wargame computer had somewhat reluctantly agreed that a partly disabled Dobra might be able to fly after spending part of the day submerged in a river, the computer also decided several of the fighters' systems would be offline or damaged. That included the stealth field and defense shield generators.
"Incoming," Derek warned.
"See them?" Irene replied quietly as she pulled the Dobra into a tight turn and pulled the nose up, crushing her down in the seat as her suit compensated for the high-G maneuver. Airspeed rapidly bled off and she pushed the nose down, aiming again for the river.
"Splash three vampires," Derek called out to alert the pilot that only one imaginary missile was now tracking them.
Irene had no time to express surprise or pleasure at their unexpected good fortune. She had to concentrate as the surface of the river was coming up fast in her forward view. At the last second, she was forced to fire the nose thrusters hard when she realized they were going to hit the water much too fast. The action of the thrusters full-on slammed her forward against the seat restraints, and her nose hit the helmet visor, leaving a smudge, and she tasted a trickle of blood running down her lip. She barely got the engine air intake doors closed before the Dobra's belly smacked the water with bone-jarring force. The fighter bounced off the surface once, twice, three times out of control, heading straight for a sandy beach and a watery bog east of the shoreline.
"We're gonna hit,"
she shouted to her co-pilot, and forced herself to relax so she wouldn't tear a muscle as the Dobra careened across the water, then dug into the beach, throwing up a cascade of sand and dark mud as the fighter crashed over the beach and into the swampy bog beyond. Irene had absolutely no control. All she could do was try to manage her frantic breathing and watch the threat display. That screen lit up as the wargame computer decided that last yellow team missile had exploded above the bouncing Dobra, and in sync, all the cockpit instruments went dead, while the Dobra's forward belly hit something more solid than sloppy bog mud. Irene's right hand instinctively wrapped around the ejection handle, ready to yank it upward and explode both her and Derek safely upward and out before the fighter's nose dug in and it flipped over onto its back to crush them for real. Just as her thumb depressed the safety button to enable the ejection handle, the Dobra stood on its nose, then flopped back down onto its belly, rocking side to side a few times.
"You okay up there?"
Derek asked, his voice strangely sounding as if he was talking through a mouthful of water.
"Yeah, you? Holy shit! What did you do? I thought we were gonna have to punch out for a second there."
Ejecting while the aircraft was in the mud was a situation Derek had not trained for or even imagined.
"Sorry, that was, kinda unplanned."
Irene could feel her cheeks reddening.
"Ah, what the hell. In a war game, you're supposed to act like we're in real combat, right? Are you really okay?"
She hit the button to release the safety straps and twisted in her seat, trying to turn her head to see her co-pilot. But her helmet was in the way, and the back of her seat blocked the view of the co-pilot pit where he sat.
"You sound odd." "I bit my lip pretty hard," Derek explained. "It's all right, Ow! Damn it! One of those slugbot things is trying to staple my freaking lips closed! Go away!"
he shouted at the slug-shaped Ruhar medical device that had emerged from a storage pouch in the neck of his flight suit and was attempting to treat the human's injury as best as it was able. When the slugbot halted but would not let go of his bleeding lip, he flipped his helmet visor up and gripped the tiny thing between two fingers, gently prying it away and flinging it onto his instrument panel, leaving a bloody trail across the displays.
"Ah!"
he jabbed a warning finger at the devoted little bot as it began crawling back toward him.
"You stay right there!
He paused to think for a moment, then found the controls to disable the slugbot.
"Hey! Irene! You see that in your display?"
Derek asked as he lowered his visor halfway.
"Uh-huh. Wargame Control says this ship is totally disabled, but we splashed all three bandits."
She switched her comm system to the guard channel, and her ears were blasted by the yellow team commander screaming a demand to know how the hell a green team fighter had just appeared out of nowhere and wasted an entire assault team. The yellow team's shocked air battle manager was screaming to clear all her aircraft away from a safe fly corridor that was now demonstrated to be anything but safe, which threw her entire air defense plan into disarray. And various yellow field commanders were scrambling to discard carefully crafted attack plans that now had to be revised on the fly. Green team commanders were seizing the opportunity to regain the initiative, and also demanding to know who the hell had been flying that Phantom Dobra.
"Sounds like we have both sides pissed at us. We must be doing something right," she chuckled. "No, I mean, you see it in your visor."
Irene paused, puzzled to understand what Derek was talking about, then saw in a flash. Her visor should only be on passive receive mode, with a blinking red icon to indicate the wargame computer had declared her dead.
"Our visors are still active. We're still alive?" "We are still alive! Yes!"
Derek exulted as he pumped a fist in the air, mistakenly thumping the inside of the canopy and bending his wrist painfully. Having the game computer decide the two human pilots had survived a crash and being struck by warhead shrapnel was about the last thing Irene expected.
"How the hell did that happen?"
"I don't know. The wargame computer should have declared us dead. It also should not have allowed our defense masers to kill three of those four yellow missiles targeting us, so I guess that computer has a sense of humor."
"Ha!" Irene laughed. "Maybe it wants to see what crazy shit us humans will do next, huh?"
Speaking of what to do next, Derek released his seat harness and retracted the rear canopy.
"Next?"
Irene retracted the forward canopy, but looked down at the murky black mud their fighter was settled into.
"Maybe we should sit right here until they send air rescue."
"No way, Jose."
Derek shook his head, stood up, and reached forward to tap the pilot's helmet.
"We're alive, and we're in enemy territory."
"Oh, damn it," Irene groaned, her notion of peacefully waiting to be plucked out of the mud swept away.
"Escape and evade?"
"Hell yes. We didn't go through that damn training for nothing."
Derek shuddered as he recalled the hellishly grueling 9-day evasion and survival training they had endured as part of qualifying for frontline service, service they had never been allowed to perform.
"We're supposed to hightail it away from the ship ASAP.
"Oh, you're right," she sighed heavily. "This is going to suck.
Come on."
Derek swung a leg over the side of the cockpit, looking for a spot in the bog where he wouldn't sink in above his neck.
You're seeing that yellow ground team, right?
His visor indicated motion on the other side of the river. The system was guessing 3 to 4 individuals headed straight for the downed Dobra. The dead ship was impossible to miss, even from a distance, as the hot exhaust nozzles were sending up pillars of steam from being partially submerged in the cold bog water.
We can at least lead those assholes on a merry chase.
It's not going to be merry at all, Irene frowned as she reached under her seat for the survival kit, seeing Derek already had his own kit slung over a shoulder.
You first.
No, ladies first, Derek winked.
It's your idea to leave a nice dry cockpit and jump into a swamp. You go first, she insisted.
Fine.
Derek lowered his visor so he could breathe even if he fell in over his head.
You know, he told himself, these damned hamster flight suits should come with a simple depth finder so he could tell how deep the water was. It was so utterly black with churned up mud that he couldn't see bottom anywhere.
Walking gingerly out along the Dobra's stubby, swept back wing, he slipped and splashed up mud and leaped overboard before he could fall. As he plunged into the water, he instinctively held his breath, though no water got through the helmet visor seal. Without him doing anything, the suit automatically inflated a collar below his neck, keeping his head above the inky black water.
I can't...
Yes, my feet are touching the bottom here.
That's great, Derek. Irene remarked with sarcasm, hands on her hips.
You're almost a foot taller than me.
Oh, right.
He walked slowly through the muck on the bog bottom, walking around to the Dobra's nose where the fighter had plowed up a ridge of mud.
Come walk out along the nose. It's shallow here.
He lifted one leg to show the water was only knee-deep in front of the fighter.
And hurry. That yellow team group Perkins ran into is only 1/2 mile from the riverbank on the other side.
Hurry, Irene thought sourly as she awkwardly climbed out of the cockpit and inched her way forward along the fighter's sleekly sloping nose.
Next time, she told herself, I'm going to let the war game computer decide I am dead so I can relax.
She waved Derek away, preferring to slide down off the fighter's nose on her own, but she slipped in the mud and fell back into his arms.
Careful. This stuff I'm standing in is like a wet sponge, he warned, sliding his visor up to breathe unfiltered air.
Irene also retracted her visor, taking a sniff of the air. To her surprise, it smelled clean, not the dank odor of a swamp. There was a burnt undertang to the scent that she attributed to heat dissipating from the engine exhaust.
Well, she inspected the sophisticated fighter that now had its bottom third submerged in mud.
This thing is Tango uniform, she smiled as she used the slang for tits up, meaning broken.
Hey, Derek patted the pilot's shapely behind. They gave us a hangar queen, and we'll give them back a genuine certified hangar queen. Nobody else will be risking their necks flying this piece of crap.
The hamsters will still be pissed that we broke it.
I say Whiskey Charlie to that, Derek laughed, meaning who cares. They will be more pissed that we popped up out of the weeds on their 6 and splashed 3 of their birds. The hamsters will be scratching their furry little heads about that one.
Hey, he gently tugged her shoulder to turn her around to face him.
That was great flying. The hamsters will add that to the textbook someday.
Thank.
Her reply was cut off as Derek leaned in to kiss her. Irene responded with enthusiasm, then put a hand on his chest and pushed him away.
Not here. Not now, her eyes twinkled to let him know that later might be different. Escape and evade, remember?
Are you escaping and evading me now?
Derek winked at her, then cocked his head and held up a finger for silence.
We've got company, he announced after hearing someone faintly shouting in the Ruhar common language.
Let's move.
Irene slapped her co-pilot's shapely ass.
Buster, buster, buster.
Buster.
Yeah, right.
Derek gritted his teeth at the pilot's direction to move as fast as possible, though thick mud was sucking at his boots and making it impossible to manage more than a slow trot.
Tell that to the mud.
Chapter 5 Emily Perkins, along with the rest of her team, had been able to follow the war game exercise through her helmet visor. Though she was technically dead according to the rules of the game, and the system prevented her from communicating with anyone other than by opening the visor and talking the old-fashioned way, she had access to all the info available to her when she had been alive. She could see the status of each member of her team, including heart rate, breathing, and other bio signs. Her suit was still receiving data through the Green Team Tactical Data Link, and that data was still subject to spoofing and jamming by the Yellow Team.